AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires. Your journey, our passion.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 278 for March 13th of 2015. From Z06 to Z0 what? Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 19 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Gary, good to see you again.
John, good seeing you. Last week you were in Geneva.
Right.
We'll talk about that a little later. And
we will talk a little bit about that later.
This is the most international show because when you were in Geneva, we had a Jeep built in Italy in the studio.
I got a chance to drive it this week. In fact, they just took it back today, too. Maybe we can talk a bit about that, too.
Right.
That's pretty interesting. Yeah, that must have been a good show.
It was. It was.
Because very interesting vehicle. And of course, Todd Lassa is in the studio with us from Automobile Magazine. And you, too, were at the Geneva show.
I, too, was at the Geneva show when I last saw you. Yes, good to see you again, John.
Yeah, good to have you here. And as Gary said, we'll talk a little bit more of some of the things that we saw at that show. But right now, we got to get to our guest. We got Tad Juxer, chief engineer for the Chevrolet Corvette, back again with us here on After Hours. Tad, great having you here.
Thank you. I wasn't at the Geneva show for the first time in 3 years, which is good and bad. I would have loved to have seen the show, but it's nice to be able to stay home and get some work done as well.
Yeah, and we should mention we've got a Z06 here in the studio with us.
A Z06 convertible.
Convertible, no
less.
Right.
So, you know, there was only one Z06 convertible ever built before this version came out in 1963 when the Z06 was first offered. And we built a handful. Only one of them was a convertible, very valuable car today. And so for 2015 with the Z06, we're bringing it back.
You built one? There was just one car,
one,
period?
Single car.
Wow.
Went to customer.
This thing's pretty cool. And, you know, I love having these cars in the studio because, of course, you can just look out at them and have all kinds of questions. And this has got all kinds of aerodynamic add-ons to it. And yet there's another step up from what you've got here on the floor today, right?
Yes, we actually have the standard Z06 here. And there's actually three levels of aerodynamics. And it's the same, whether it's a coupe or convertible. In fact, all the performance options, you can get all of them on either the coupe or convertible, your choice. So we're showing the standard aerodynamic package here. As you go up, you get more aggressive front splitters, you get a more aggressive rear spoiler, and then what we call a level 3, the top package, which comes with our Z07. So that's the Pilot Sport Cup tires and the ceramic brakes. Then you get giant end caps on the end of the front splitter, makes it look like a military aircraft, and then what we call a clear bridge wicker, which actually bolts onto the back end of the car, has slots in it that customers can adjust to fine-tune the handling of the car the way they like it for any particular track.
So this is a 650 horsepower car and it's convertible. How did you do that without making it like a shake, rattle, and roll vehicle?
Well, from inception, we knew it was going to be a convertible. In the previous generation car, the sixth generation car, as you know, the Z06 was a fixed roof only, manual transmission only. And one thing we've learned is denying customers what they want is a bad business strategy. You know, people want what they want. So we heard a lot of questions. Why can't I get an automatic? You know, my spouse and I can't agree on manual or automatic. Why can't I get a convertible? I want the best of best. I want all the performance, but I also want the full open air experience. So from the inception on the seventh generation car, we said, you know what, we're going to offer it all. Mix and match however you want. And so really this car that you see here today, even though we introduced it more than a year after we introduced the car, this was the car we had to engineer the rest of the body structure to. So the Z06 high track load.
So you started with this design.
We started this one, but
even
it's,
though
the,
it's
last
the last car
one.
Out.
Yes, exactly. So you have to have very good kind of forward thinking. You have to project what the loads are going to be on track, even for a convertible version. And then bake that into your structural design. That way you can kind of, the coupe is relatively straightforward. You know, it just gets that much better because you've designed it from open air from the beginning.
Well, and Tad, some of the purists are a little bit up in arms about this being a convertible Z06. So what's the difference in weight between the new Z06 coupe and the Z06 convertible?
Okay, it's about 60 pounds for the convertible, and it all has to do with the folding hardtop. We now have a one-button top, so all the power, you know, hydraulics, electronics, control systems, that's 60 pounds. Whether it's a Stingray or a Z06, it's the same 60-pound difference.
You know what I like about this rear wing that you've got is it's got like a little wicker bill with screws, so you can take it off. If I bought this base one and I went, I need more wing, could I go out and buy the extra parts and just bolt them on?
Yes, you can buy all the accessories. You can buy the front splitter. You can buy the rocker extensions. You can buy the more aggressive wickers. You can buy the bridge piece I was talking about. And it's an easy bolt-on. One of the reasons we do it the way we do it is because this car still has really good luggage volume, and we really want to preserve the car's bandwidth. So, yeah, you can go hammer on the track. It's awesomely capable on the track. But then you also want to go on a cross-country drive, and you want to bring all your luggage. So we really want to make the car easy to use in a lot of things. So that's why we stepped away from the idea of doing a giant wing like you see on race cars. The wicker strategy actually lets us create a high-pressure bubble all over the back end of the car, so it evenly distributes the downforce over the existing body panels.
Tad, explain that a little bit, because I'm fascinated by this. You're creating a bubble of air by adding the wicker in the back.
Yes.
And that's so it's distributing pressure throughout the trunk.
Yeah, if you looked at our analytical models, you can visualize it very well. You create high pressure on the forward face of that wicker. The bigger it is, the more high pressure. The bigger that bubble is, the farther forward it actually extends, so it covers a greater area of the back of the car. So even a small change in pressure over that larger area creates a lot of downforce. And that's how we get such good aerodynamic performance on this car, such amazing cornering Gs on this car at speed, such good racetrack performance, yet with a relatively little aerodynamic device.
So do you get a different rear wing if you get a different Z06 package with it, or is that the only wing?
That's what I was talking about. The top level, the level 3 package, comes with the Z07. So that's like the most hardcore package. So you get the Pilot Sport Cup tires, which are basically
it's
barely
really a track
legal.
Car.
Right? It's really for people who want to track.
You're not going to put luggage in the trunk of that, therefore the liftover.
It's compromised. It's higher, but it's still way better than a wing would be.
You know, back to what I was saying about the convertible version of this car, if you were Porsche, you'd probably have about 5 different wing variations at different option prices, wouldn't you?
At least 5.
And maybe throw in an optional pit crew so they can change it for you.
Leather covered, whatever you want.
But you do have fitted luggage for the convertible?
Yeah, we have a lot of accessories. Custom luggage that fits in really well is really high quality stuff. It's got the Corvette emblem.
Did the Corvette designers design the luggage?
Yes. We had a big hand, and actually, a lot of us got a chance to say what we liked. You know, it's a multi piece luggage set, and it's selling very well. I think we've sold close to 2,000 sets of luggage, which is far more than I would have expected.
You know, it cracks me up. You talk to automotive designers who, in my opinion, have the best job in the world, they get to design cars. But they love doing luggage and tables and lamps and other stuff like that.
There's no detail too small. I mean, these guys, when they're not designing cars, they're designing logoed shirts, you know, for our events. Any design challenge they're up for.
So speaking of the design, I mean, every element on this car is functional. It isn't just like a decal that looks good. But
and that's been a mantra on Corvette for a long time. We don't put stuff on just for appearance sake. It all has to work. Has to look better and look better in a way that makes the car actually work better. So that's, you know, when we introduced the Stingray, we talked a lot about that, taking basically the racing car strategies on aerodynamics and applying them, not verbatim, because racing cars are kind of brutal and they don't care about luggage space and they don't care about seamless integration of panels. You know, they're extraordinarily hardcore. We care about that, so we need a kind of an elegant, good-looking way of having the same kind of strategies. And that's why the car really is very compelling. Even from when the Stingray came out, the car was like a magnet to people because they could see the functionality, the power of the design was obvious, right from day one.
But they had to elevate it for the Z06.
Well, the Z06 is everything on steroids. So, you know, the loads are higher, the aerodynamic loads are higher. You got more air coming in to cool the engine. You need to exit more out of the engine compartment. So the hood vent is larger, the fender vents are larger, and then the whole back end of the car is wider. You can see on the coupe, especially the quarter scoops, are now snorkels that reach up and catch the air. Extremely sophisticated design. I could spend 10 minutes just talking about the design elements that go into that quarter scoop. So it's all the same kind of strategies, but amped up.
How did you incorporate that into the design, making the bigger scoops, the wider back end, and from a tooling standpoint? Because usually you'd go, ooh, yeah, they're great idea, but we're just going to have to spend more money. Or were there some clever things you spent the money? Or are there other things that you did, well, we can use an insert here?
We looked for ways to economize on tooling. Lots of times it's not what we call the primary tool, the part of, you know, the tool that makes the part that you see, but a lot of the secondaries, like things that bond onto the backside, making those shared between what we call narrow body cars and wide body cars, checking fixtures, trying to make them as common as we can. So, you know, the quarter panel is much wider, but it goes back to a common body structure. So a lot of the surfaces that you don't see are common. So when you're checking to those really important functional interfaces,
the hard points,
it's the same. Yeah. So you can use a lot of common tooling there.
Mm-hmm. Now, when the Z06 first appeared, I guess it was the C5, and it was just the formal hard top, the formal coupe design. Can you talk a little bit about how the Z06 brand, because it's kind of become its own brand, has evolved since that car?
Sure, and that was actually the second time it appeared. The first time was in 1963,
Where
Zora was trying to sneak racing hardware out the factory door, and so there was a special RPO, regular production option, Z06, so that people in the know, not very many of them, could check that box and get a 36-gallon fuel tank and get all sorts of custom stuff that was ready to go racing. So, you know, GM put an end to that back then, and we brought it back, as you said, actually in 2001, and if you recall, when the fifth generation came out, we were coming out of a really bad recession. The Corvette came close to dying multiple times. The fourth generation car ran 13 years. A lot of people thought the segment was dying. And so the idea back then was to try to get the price point down, down, down. And so we had a coupe convertible, and then we had a bunch of names for it, but there was a fixed roof, kind of back to basics Corvette that a lot of customers said they wanted, but it was really back to basics. It had cloth seats. It had a mirror. The passenger mirror, you had to ask your passenger to adjust for you.
How do you get by doing all that?
It was the idea, believe it or not, way back then, was to get to something like a $30,000 Corvette.
Right.
And, you know, the coupe and convertible were high 30s at that point. And so we actually engineered this fixed roof car, but the fifth generation was such a hit. We brought it out. The plant was running max overtime. The car was apparently worth more than what we were pricing it at. People were charging more for it. So the coupe and convertible were selling really well. And so we were sitting here with this model that was going to undercut that business and sell at lower margins. It just didn't make any sense. But it had some attributes. It was the lightest of the three since it was a fixed roof. It was the stiffest of the three. And so we said, you know what makes most sense? Let's just offer this as, you know, up-level chassis only, manual transmission only, and it'll be our, you know, sportiest coupe, you know, for somebody who's truly hardcore. Honestly, that's kind of a collector's car today because it's a rare car that it just didn't have enough content to be a big pull. But it was a start, and 2 years later, you know, we upgraded with its own powertrain, an upgraded engine, 385 horsepower, chassis. We did more work around the car to make it more special, more bespoke track car. But it was still that back-to-basics track car. And really, from then, we've been evolving on through the fifth generation, sixth generation, and now the seventh generation car. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And now it's like part of the Corvette lore. You know, everybody just expects it. You know, we did it once in 1963. We did it again in the fifth generation. There was no guarantee that we were going to do it again. But now everybody just expects it. And like you say, it's become a brand unto itself, kind of a golden standard for performance.
And this is on sale currently? Or
yes. How many? We've been selling at quite a great rate. We started last fall with the manual transmission cars. We just started a few weeks ago, actually, shipping automatic transmission cars. And right now, 40% of our orders are Z06s.
Is that really?
40% of your orders.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's unreal.
Any early?
Did you guys ever think that it would hit that high a rate?
No.
No.
We knew initially there'd be a spike in demand.
Sure.
And I don't know how long that's going to last.
Man.
And people have seen
the car.
Because
what's this car priced at?
Well, it starts about 80, but you can quickly get to 100 if you check about it. Just...
And any early indication of like what the mix is going to be on the Z06 only between convertible and hardtop, manual and automatic?
I think it's about 80-20.
80 coupe.
Anything 20%.
I know it's early with automatic since you've just launched it. But.
And that's a tough question because we introduced the car manual only, so it was 100% manual.
Right.
And then when you introduce the automatic, there's a pent-up demand for automatics, and some of the dealers have manuals on the lot. So now it's 80% automatic. I expect it'll end up balancing closer to our traditional penetration of 60 to 70% automatics.
What kind of automatic do you have in the vehicle?
It's an 8-speed. This actually, you know, we introduced the 8-speed last year, and we put it in the Stingray starting for 2015 model year. But again, this was the car that we designed that transmission for. Its package, its torque, its horsepower, its duty cycle. This was the car that set the specifications to engineer that ground-up transmission for us.
And very fast shifting, right?
Very fast shifting. If you've read some of the media, you just put it in drive, go out on the track. It's not just fast, but it's very intuitive. In fact, a lot of pro drivers have said, you know, this does shifts I would never consider doing myself. But out there on the track, when I can just focus on gas, steering, and braking, they make sense, and I'm faster. So we're getting pretty good marks for the transmission behaves.
Where do you think that's all going to go? Because the automatics are getting so good. We're seeing some storied brands like Ferrari and all walking away from manuals altogether.
And I tell people it's not a question of if, it's when, right? Mm-hmm. Eventually, manual. Think about if it was the other way, where we started with automatic transmissions, and then some guy came in and said, I have an idea. Let's do a transmission where you move this big lever, and I put a third pedal down there, and you step on it to disconnect the engine from the trans, and then you move the lever. And if you brought that idea into a world that was filled with automatics, people would say you're insane. You'd never sell any of those.
As long as he said it's a small lever, I would still be.
But, is it predicated on control logic and better algorithms, or what's causing the automatic to get so much better and capable of making these very
the automatics faster. Are capable of moving a lot faster than a human can move, and the human also has a pretty big workload on track and other times, so being able to maintain torque through a shift like an acceleration runs is a huge advantage. So we can do that on ours. Anybody who has a DCT, you can maintain torque. So even though you're shifting, you're still getting torque to the wheels versus a manual transmission. While you're shifting, the car's actually decelerating, right? You're coasting during that time. So you're losing performance that way. So I think the days of the manual transmission are numbered. We're proud to be still offering, you know, two world-class transmissions, a 7-speed rev-matching manual for people who really like that driving experience. Me, myself, it's, you know, more engaging. It's part of the driving experience. It's part of the fun.
I prefer it.
And we got plenty of customers right now say, I don't really care. I don't get every tenth of a second out of the performance anyway. It's my fun car. I got three other cars. This is my fun car. Why do I want to just stick it in D? So right now we're in that transition period where we still have a lot of hardcore people. You know, we're one of the only games in town left.
What kind of cracks me up is the U.S. market might be the last bastion when the dust settles of getting a manual transmission in a performance car.
It could be.
And who would have ever thought that?
Yeah, the only reason BMW still offers it in an M5. But so this is a traditional torque converter,
we would call it.
Yeah,
torque converter.
Was there any discussion, or did you do any work on a DCT for this? Did you consider that? And what did you see the advantage to this transmission being for this, this sort of car?
Yeah, the natural question, and most customers say, well, why didn't you use a DCT? What they really want is a very quick, very responsive transmission. That's what they want, because that DCT has become synonymous with paddle shifting, instantaneous shifts.
Right.
We looked at a DCT. There's no existing DCT in the world that can take 650 foot-pounds of torque and fit in our architecture where we have the transmission package in the back. So it was going to be a new design from scratch. So we could have said, well, let's design a DCT from scratch. Now, in terms of shared usage around General Motors, the DCT would not have been shared. Mm-hmm. But independent of that, just looking at the best solution for Corvette, we challenged our transmission guys. We said, you got to match the DCT for all the attributes that people like DCT for. So shift speed, shift quality, all those things. But we really want to one better them, because a DCT over the life of the car, there's a lot of kind of traditional torque converter or automatic transmission use cases where it's actually superior. Traffic, you know, moving around in traffic, mm-hmm. it's much smoother, it's slicker. It's a torsional damper in the driveline, so it's very well behaved in situations like that. So we really wanted the best of both worlds. And then kind of the icing on the cake was the fact that we have cylinder deactivation in this car. When you take a V8 and run it in V4, the crankshaft is no longer spinning smoothly. And being able to use a torque converter to dampen that driveline vibration lets you be very aggressive in what we call AFM operation. That is more of an efficiency enabler than the DCT, which is like a manual transmission in terms of rotating efficiency.
And it shifts faster than the Porsche PDK, right?
We benchmarked the PDK, and we've said it can't. If there's a lot of different shift events, some it's faster, some it's slower, but on average, it's right a perfect match with the PDK.
Very interesting. Well, we're going to come back in a moment here and talk more Corvette, but we got to take a quick break right now and give a shout out to our friends at Bridgestone.
If you want to make things that move, move better, just talk to one of our scientists. They'll show you a special glue we've developed that bonds metal to plastic. And that makes the things you're trying to move lighter. The less weight, the less energy. And what you save can be used for speed, for efficiency, or just for fun. This is the human element at work. Dow.
Well, clearly that was not Bridgestone, and that's my fault for not reading my show notes, and we want to thank Dow. We'll get to Bridgestone later in the show. Hey, we've got a whole bunch of questions here, Taj, from the audience. Speedy Sticks tweeted this in, says, why didn't the Corvette body ever make it big in NHRA funny car competition? Can you see it returning to NHRA funny car?
I think it's unlikely. You know, we do endurance racing with our car. That's the closest crossover, you know, to a performance sports car in terms of track to street technology. Drag racing is really fun. It's really cool. It's less tied into improving the breed from a sports car standpoint. Within the Chevrolet portfolio, it's more of a muscle car, more of a Camaro domain than really for us.
Yeah. See, we got another one here from Steve Reed, Corvette owner since 1988, says, why was the C7 Z06 1.4 seconds slower around Willow Springs than the GTR Nismo? If all-wheel drive is such a performance advantage, any chance we might see it in a future Corvette?
Okay, well, the Motor Trend article, we screwed up. We sent them a car where the alignment was not right. We got, you know, once the Z06 came out, we've had demand for cars around the world for comparison tests. And we got a fairly big fleet, and we try to keep them in perfect condition. We screwed up when we sent that car out with lousy alignment. We knew something was wrong because Randy Probst was driving, and he was talking about the car oversteering, which wasn't what he experienced. He was at our long lead at Road Atlanta. The car wasn't behaving. That's not the way the car is tuned, so we knew something was wrong with that car. We got it back and confirmed, yep, the suspension was way out of alignment. So that might not have made up the whole difference, but we actually did go out to Willow Springs and check the car out for ourselves. As it happened, while we were out there, Motor Trend was out there testing some other vehicles after we had fixed the car, and we kind of played around with some of the chassis tuning and so forth, because we had never been to that track. We let them jump in the car a second time, and I think they're going to publish what they found, but let's just say we did better.
Okay.
Is all-wheel drive intrinsically better for...
All-wheel drive has a lot of advantages in that you can take advantage of all four tire patches in a lot of situations. It's best for 0-60, but it's also good on road courses. You know, it's good for that. It's bad for power-to-weight ratio. It's bad for spin losses, chassis losses in the car. So it's a balance. For our car, we've looked at all-wheel drive. Our engine is so low that the crank throws are right down on the ground line. So the solution that most people use for all-wheel drive is to run a prop shaft back through the oil pan to get out to power the front wheels. Our engine is so low, there's nobody who has a V8 under a hood as low as ours. There's no room to run that prop shaft. So we kind of had to decide, what are we going to be? What are we going to optimize around? If you do all-wheel drive, you compromise the whole architecture. and for that all-wheel drive. So we're really a point solution for front-engine V8, rear-wheel drive, efficient open air. I mean, that is our formula that we've been fine-tuning for generation after generation.
Here's another question that I would have asked if Jeff Taylor hadn't asked it. And he says, I'd like to ask Mr. Juchter, if given carte blanche in creating a new Super Corvette, would it be rear mid-engine versus the current front mid-engine?
I don't know what carte blanche means. It's easy to do a car with no budgets. You know, if you can just spend whatever you want, charge whatever you want. The current car, and people ask me all the time, you know, why didn't you go mid-engine? And we've talked about it public. We looked at mid-engine as a alternative to this for the seventh generation car. And we've always said when the whole car gets better, it's almost like the all-wheel drive question. When the whole car gets better as a mid-engine architecture, we would do it. Mid-engine requires a lot of compromises. You look at the elite race programs around the world, they're all mid-engine. So purely performance, if all you care is purely performance, then it makes sense to put the engine in the back. If you're still talking about a car that's going to be used as a daily driver, a long-distance tour, as well as on the track, and you want the car handled very benignly on the track and have accessible performance, there's a whole bunch of other things that come into what is the optimum. And you look at Ferrari. Ferrari does a 458, now a 488, that's mid-engine. But you go up from there, and they do a front-engine V8 car. So there's attributes for...
Well, Ferrari's got several models.
Right.
Should they go Corvette. Yeah. Ford's coming out with the GT. You know, do you need to be able to say, yeah, we can do that,
if
too?
Somebody wants to throw billions of dollars at me, we'll do multiple models. We'll cover the whole range.
It sounds like Padge is disclaiming all the rumors, obviously. And there was a TV show last week that had some Chevrolet supposedly future stuff shown. Do you know the show? I can't recall. It's something that nobody's seen, basically. It's on one of the, I think it's on NBC Sports or something like that.
Cable and, access.
The interwebs have gone wild with speculation that what they showed was this alleged Corvette Duntov or Arcus, whatever.
Zora. Rumor of the Zora. Right.
The Zora.
Well, I'll have to check that out because I know no such car exists.
Yeah. Well, and frankly, and I know you're not going to
see what
respond.
You're supposed to be engineering.
Yeah. Frankly, I think if such a car exists, it belongs to another division, is my speculation.
Oh, but interesting spec.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. Maybe we can talk about that later.
Maybe with another guest.
Maybe with another guest,
yeah.
Sure.
Dennis M. says, I'm a huge fan of the Z06. Unfortunately, being very tall, headroom is insufficient for me. Any customization available from the factory?
Not from the factory. He doesn't say how tall he is.
No, he doesn't.
But I've seen, just not from the factory, I've seen people modify their cars, lower the seats. I've even seen people remove the seat and just put pads around the interior, custom fit to them. We kind of have to shoot for the middle of the market. Corvette's a high-volume car. And so the tail ends of the distribution, people kind of, you know, I hear this all the time from extra large people and extra small people, that the car doesn't fit them just right. So we're trying to make sure the car appeals to as many people as possible. And we'd like to fit, you know, people who are 6'8", 6'10", in the car, but that means raising the roof. It means raising the center of gravity of the car, increasing the frontal area. You know, there's all these downsides to just putting additional room in the car. So we try to shoot to all the way to 99th percentile. We try to do, you know, 1% to 99th percentile. Try to make people as happy as possible. But then there's some that we just don't fit in.
Yeah.
And we are sorry because there's a lot of pro athletes. They're big people with lots of money, and we'd love to take their money.
Yeah. Multiple times. Hey, we've got a phone call here. And so, Ben, let's bring that one in.
Hi, this is George from Sunnyvale, California. Rule number one for great sports cars is that they be light and nimble. The C6 Z06 is a great example of this. Unfortunately, the C7 Z06 does not follow the same design philosophy and is 350 pounds heavier. There should not be a convertible or open roof version of the Z06 so that frame can be light as it was in the C6. There are better ways to improve gas mileage in a sports car than cylinder deactivation, which adds too much weight and reduces maximum engine RPM. Now we hear the C7 Z06 runs hot and reduces power after only four laps on the track, a problem the C6 Z06 never had. Please tell us that the C8 design philosophy will get back to rule number one. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Okay. Well, that was, I think you covered a lot of ground there. What I can tell you is that talking about future product is prohibited. I'd get fired if I talk about future product. Obviously, and I've said before, our first thought for the Z06 was we wanted to replicate the LS7. That's the engine he's talking about. So high revving, small block V8. You know, we did a 427, a 7-liter engine. Obviously, putting a supercharger adds mass, but and doing direct injection, variable valve timing on that formula seemed like the right answer. And I was right there. That's what I thought. That's what I assumed from the beginning we would do. But technologically, it did not turn out to be the right solution. We couldn't get any more power out of that engine than we were getting out of the 505 horsepower LS7 previously. The new requirements for emissions, our own internal durability requirements, a host of other issues came up that we couldn't just apply that formula and get a significant performance advance. I really wanted to do it. At some point in the future, would we like to have that, you know, purest car, you know, that a Z06 has kind of come to be expected, pure race car expression? Yeah, I'd love to do that. And when technology allows us to do it, we'll do it.
Yeah. Hey, look, with that, we're going to have to wrap up the segment with you, Tej, but it's been awesome having you here.
Thank you.
Thanks for answering so many questions, too. This is really good stuff, and even more for bringing a Z06 into the studio, convertible, no less.
And it's getting time. We can drive it.
Yeah, it is. Up in the northern climes here, boy, it's starting to turn sunny and warm. Of course, after experience 10 below zero, even 20 degrees feels warm now. And, of course, I'm talking Fahrenheit.
I'm ready for top-down weather. You're going to leave that behind for us, aren't you?
As far as I'm concerned,
yeah. Yes. Yeah. Just tell them you forget where the car is for about a week or two. Mm-hmm. So, Tadge Juchter, thanks so much for coming on Autoline.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome having you.
Enjoyed
here.
It.
And now we are going to take another quick break. And this time we are going to give a shout out to our good friends at Bridgestone. So, did we just make news on this show? There is no rear mid-engine Corvette?
From my point of view, he looked very sincere, like he almost didn't know what we were talking about. And I really believe that it's going to be a Cadillac.
Well, he said, and we'll have to go back and parse the tape to get the exact quote, but I think he said, I know of no such
car. Yeah, he rationalized why there wouldn't be one.
Right.
And therefore, if given that rationalization, it would seem surprising to me that it would even be a Cadillac, because, I mean, doesn't Cadillac need some volume?
Well, Cadillac needs prestige, and they need to compete with Audi and BMW and Mercedes-Benz. And when I interviewed Johann Denisian back in the fall when he came over to Cadillac after he'd been there for a short time, he spoke about the cars that he'd like to see. Obviously, these were cars that were in the works before he joined Cadillac, and he talked about how he'd like to see some sports cars. Mm-hmm. And it just makes all kinds of sense that if there is a mid-engine car, there have been spy shots of this General Motors mid-engine car, that it would be a Cadillac and not a Corvette.
Yeah. It's a real expensive way to go.
Well, it just seemed odd to me that, if you're developing a car, that you wouldn't talk to the chief engineer of Corvette.
Well,
I mean, it's just, I'm just saying, you know what I mean? It's just, and if they didn't, then shame on them.
Yeah, shame on them, exactly.
Well, back during the Detroit Auto Show 2 months ago or so, I had a chance to talk with Bob Lutz and Don Runkle. And as you guys know, Don used to run advanced engineering at Chevrolet. And that was the whole discussion. Would there ever be a rear mid-engine Corvette? And both of them agreed that GM will do all the design studies, maybe even build a working prototype, and will never tool it up and put it in production.
Why do they think that would be the case?
Cost. They just thought for volume and cost that they just were not going to pull the trigger. And now that the Wall Street bozos have, you know,
your guy Harry Wilson that you
talked about. Yeah, if anybody's killed off Midge and Corvette, it's Harry Wilson for sure.
Harry Wilson and his Wall Street thieves is the way I look at it. I mean, I think they've hurt the
company.
I'm
with you, John. Yeah. And, you know, the argument goes that, well, the next step in optimum performance and handling as well as straight-line performance would be mid-engine. But on the other hand, look at Porsche, the 911. It may be the engine may have inched up a little bit over that rear axle, but it's still a rear engine car.
That's a great point, Todd. That's a great point. And, you know, has anyone berated Porsche for, you know, not going on and doing more exotic things with the 911? No, they haven't. It's true to what it's always been.
Right. And I think that's what the Corvette will always be. Mm-hmm. But watch Cadillac. I'm convinced that if they're really going to build a mid-engine car, and to your point, Harry Wilson may have put the kibosh on it, I'm convinced that it would be a Cadillac.
Mm-hmm. If they're keeping like $20 billion on hand, you should think that they'd be able to.
I know, but I don't think $20 billion's enough money.
Not anymore.
I got to look this up. What does GM spend every year? Mm-hmm. You know, I like to see a business that's got enough cash on hand to run for the rest of the year.
Right.
You know, and $20 billion, my guess would be, about 2 months of cash for GM?
No, but when they made that announcement, I mean, they sort of walked it through in terms of we've got this much for this, this much for this, this much for this, and this is a safe amount to have. So I don't think their burn rate would be such.
What's the UAW contract going to cost? What's the Department of Transportation fine for the ignition switch recall going to cost? And you never know what's going to happen in this business, and it's, I don't know, I keep saying that when Alfred Sloan ran General Motors, and it was the revered Alfred Sloan, and he ran it brilliantly, and GM was considered the best investment going. It was blue chip. No one ever bought General Motors to make instant riches. You bought it because you got steady returns year after year.
Well, and Wall Street was probably a lot different back then, too.
Well,
now
you've got all these
arbitragers and hedge fund managers, and they're all just out to make a killing year by year by year. And, you know, it's... Yeah, there is one thing we do know about the auto industry. There'll be another downturn. There'll be another 12 million or less year
before
the decade's up. And GM and Ford and Fiat Chrysler and all the rest, Toyota, Daimler, have to be prepared for that.
Right. I totally agree. So I found it very interesting that Warren Buffett came out and said, this is a stupid idea.
Yeah.
And they shouldn't be doing
buying
it.
Buying that guy off?
Buying the guy off. And, well, he said, don't put any short-termer on your board, somebody who's only in it for, a quick buck.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, look, here's the guy that just bought the Van Tuyl dealership group and who came out and said, I expect this business to be growing and thriving 50 to 100 years from now. And I thought, that's the kind of thinking the GM board needs, not shake out $5 billion. And actually, it's $10 billion. Marianne Keller pointed this out because they've committed to $5 billion in dividends above and beyond what they've been paying. And now they're going to do $5 billion in stock buyback. So it's really a $10 billion hit. Mm-hmm. So anyway, let's talk about fun stuff.
Yeah.
So Geneva, Todd, about this time last week, you and I were flying back from Geneva. I'm dying to know, what were some of your takeaways from the show?
Well, I think the Bentley Speed 6 was obviously the star of the show. I think there was a curious kind of absence of anything new or special from some key players at Geneva, even though overall I thought it was a very good show, but you didn't have anything big from BMW, you didn't have anything big from Fiat or Alfa Romeo or Maserati as you did last year. Mm-hmm. But overall, I think it was a good, solid Geneva, a lot of fun. Ford was touting his new performance group. I ran an online story based on a very good, unimpeachable source that Ford plans to show a car before the end of the year that would be a competitor for the Chevrolet Bolt. Not Volt.
Bolt with a B as in boy.
So that's a small 200-mile electric car.
A 200-plus mile electric car and a cost of somewhere around $30,000 after tax credits. And if you think about it, just a couple weeks earlier, Apple had stolen some Ford engineers, and you know, why would they be interested in Ford engineers? Probably some engineers who were working on electric cars, which everybody has to be doing now. Every competitive major automaker has to be doing so. While Ford officially denied it, called the story inaccurate, I'm very confident that it's accurate.
And if you're saying by the end of the year, that would might suggest the L.A. Auto Show?
That's what I...
Because, I mean, more EVs are sold in California than anywhere, and I'm not just talking in the United States. Yeah. I'm talking just about anywhere in the world.
So that's so why, what I speculated.
Why would they do it?
To be competitive with Chevrolet, for one thing, to show that they're in the game, not just with Chevrolet, but with all the other major players, from Nissan to Tesla, which we're still waiting for its $30,000 or $35,000 electric car, just to be competitive.
Yeah, and not only that, don't forget there's a ZEV mandate, and you got to accumulate those zero-emission vehicle credits. So that's another reason, because the Ford Fusion electric, they don't sell a whole lot of those. So maybe they'd sell more of a cheaper one. But anyway, hey, look, we're going to take another quick promotional break here, and let's come back and talk more stuff that we saw in Geneva and whatever else is going on. You already know that you can listen to AutoLine's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to AutoLine.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play just like you would on your computer.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from AutoLine's top-notch insider information with AutoLine on the go. So we're talking about electric cars and maybe Ford coming with a competitor to the Bolt. What I thought was the most significant car at the Geneva show was this Nano Flow Cell, Quant F and Quantino. And the reason I say that is they're powered by flow cells. Mm-hmm. So we know there's batteries. We know there's fuel cells. And then there's this thing called flow cells, which I know, Gary, you've talked a little bit about it because I still don't understand how it works. They run on liquid salt.
Which gives it a 500-mile range.
Well, they have a huge tank, a 95-gallon tank.
But then after 500 miles, you need to refill the tank.
And you do.
There's two tanks.
A negative and a positive.
Because you have this electrolytic solution. So I'm more skeptical than John is on this whole thing, and I find it always skeptical when I find somebody who makes the announcement that the redox flow cell, which is the real name for these things, which is red for reduction and then electron uptake and oxidation, that's what that whole thing means. So I looked into this because, you know, NASA invented this, right? That's what they claim, of course. I mean, if NASA invented it, it's got to be good. So just as a public service, I went and looked to see what was really true. Tang, Teflon, Velcro, barcodes, quartz clocks, smoke detectors, cordless power tools, and MRI were not invented by NASA, just in case anybody was wondering. Temper foam, though,
for your
Tempur-Pedic mattress, that was developed under a NASA contract. So that's just to get that out there.
Well, okay, tell me who else would really drink Tang if you didn't have to have it up in space.
Tang was invented before the space program, but they went up. Anyway, so... So what I thought was interesting is there is a lot of serious work being done, you know, all over the world. I mean, Oak Ridge Labs, right. and so the most interesting thing that I found was the Fraunhofer Institute, which is a renowned German organization that does this sort of thing. Is they're looking at it for stationary storage, okay, of cells. So basically, what you have is a vehicle that has two large tanks of this stuff, It's basically a fuel cell car. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we all have commented in the past about the expense and the complexity of creating the fuel cell stack. Well, these guys have that very same problem. So this is why I'm sort of wondering about
it. They do, except in a fuel cell stack, you have to use expensive materials like platinum. My understanding is the flow cell is you can make it a whole lot cheaper. You make the plates out of steel, not platinum.
Well, so most of these guys are talking about vanadium. That seems to be the material that people are using, and that's the secret thing here. But I just find it. The charge carrier within the carrier liquid have been taken to a new level of charge density through the use of quantum electric nano mechanisms.
I know.
Okay.
Yeah. You got to be careful when you hear that.
Come on. You know what I mean? You know, we got a Corvette over there, right? I mean, yeah. that just seems to me that's as close as we're going to get to quantum
nano, whatever
yes,
it was.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. But I've talked to a couple of people I know who are familiar with flow cells, and they were intrigued that someone put one in a car. They were intrigued by that.
Well, let me ask you, when you say put one in a car, I wasn't able to spend as much time, I think, as you were at the quant stand.
Yeah, right.
How real was that? Was it just a fiberglass body?
No,
and they
it's a real car. It's totally real.
They said
car.
It's got it's, that powertrain underneath.
It's GUV approved.
Okay.
Which is the German organization that any automaker of any sort, low or high volume, has to get TÜV approval before the thing can go out on the street.
Okay.
And this has got that TÜV approval. And
then so it's been on the street.
Yeah,
they've tested it.
See, but what I understand, I was looking at the charts and graphs that they have on their website. What happens to the fluid?
I don't understand that, Gary. I asked them that, and their English wasn't very good.
Maybe it's a full loss system.
And my German's non-existent.
So basically, you have these two large tanks,
yeah,
right? And then it goes through the nano cell. Mm-hmm. And then it goes. Part of it goes into a supercapacitor. They're keeping some of the ionic energy there, and then they're taking some and then using it. So this is an electric car. Mm-hmm. It has four electric motors on it, and I'm just mystified as to what happens to all of this
I
liquid.
I asked them that, and they I don't speak German. Their English was reasonable, but not all that great, and I couldn't get that answer out of them. And so I said, so do you suck the old fluid out to put in the new? And they were like, they looked at me like I was crazy. They said, no, you just fill it up with the new stuff.
Right. That's what. So where does
where's all the salt go?
I did
well,
speak
that
with
that all goes through the thing. It's not the salt. It's the liquid that carries the salt.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So
it's an electrolyte.
Right. Yeah.
That's what it is.
So,
it's an electrolyte.
So what you know, my basic understanding is that basically you run this through the nano flow cell,
mm-hmm,
and then you get the ionic action which creates the electricity. But the carrier medium, the liquid stuff, which is they claim is very benign. Let's say it is, right? But do they spill it on the ground? I mean, does it come out of the bottom of the car as you're driving? Because they're also making the point that you can refill this the same way you basically refill a vehicle. And then because they have the two tanks, they have two places to put the liquid in.
Yeah.
Because they're two different liquids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's one's charged positively, the other's charged
right
negatively. And I'm guessing that the flow cell process is you're getting electrons on the negative side to jump to the positive side, and that flow of electrons is your electricity, blah, 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 and then that makes mm-hmm the car go. But, yeah, I got to learn more about where's the fluid go?
Yeah, so where's the fluid go? And then, we think we have problems with electric cars in terms of where you charge them. Where the hell are you going to get this, what is that fluid called again?
It's an ionic fluid.
Yeah.
No, you just charge the fluid. I mean, you literally get a tank and you plug it in, you zap electricity into this electrolyte, like any battery, which then holds it, and then you pour the liquid into the tank, but it takes a huge amount, like I said, 95 gallons, but that gives you a 500-mile driving range, so they claim, and I don't know what cycle that's on, if it's just a steady 40 miles an hour or what. And they're also claiming with the car that they're showing, the Quant F, a top speed of nearly 190 miles an hour.
And
the thing looks sensational. It's beautifully built.
Is it huge?
It's about the size of a Tesla Model S. It's a four-door, too.
That's okay. It weighs more than a Tesla Model S. I checked that out.
With a full tank.
Yeah, I would imagine, yeah. I didn't get a close look at the stand, but I did speak to someone from MB Tech, which did the bodies for the cars. And I was under the impression, and he was, too, and he's, again, on the body side, body engineering side, not on the powertrain technology side, but I had the impression from what he was saying that they do drain or suck fluid out and put the new fluid in after 500 miles. And of course, as with any other kind of new technology, the problem would be infrastructure, at least
right.
at the beginning.
Yeah.
One other.
These guys were saying, no, you don't suck any fluid out.
And again, he was a body guy.
And they said you could set up a pump at any gas station. They said, we're talking liquid salt. It's not flammable. It's not toxic. It's, you know, you can store it very easily, unlike hydrogen, and not prone to battery fires like lithium ion can be.
One of the car I didn't have time to pay attention to was the new Opel Karl, which is their new B car, or actually it's an A car. And at the beginning of
Isn't
April,
it just a spark. With
it is a spark. So at the reason I didn't pay attention to it is I thought it was the current spark, badge engineered to be an Opel and a Vauxhall, but it's the all new spark, which Chevrolet is showing and did a little teaser on. We'll be showing at the New York Auto Show next month. So while they're saying, "Oh, we're not going to show this car until April," basically, if you look at the Opel Karl. It's got a different front fascia, of course, and some other detailing, but it's the same car.
But you thought it was the.
I looked at it so quickly.
Sure
I didn't know.
It sure looks like.
But if you look at the pictures, the side surfacing is a little bit different, a little more expressive, a little more of that.
No, the styling's
style.
Different, the skin's different, but I think the basics.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know that it's I don't think it's an all new car because the Spark has only been on the market for a few years, but. It's a heavily. I think there's some new sheet metal beside the, not just a facelift. I think it's more than that. And again, so if you want to look at the Chevy Spark,
but doesn't it need more expressiveness?
Well, yeah, of course.
It's just like you look at that thing. It's just like
another technology I found very interesting at Geneva was BMW was showing water injection. They had a pace car for MotoGP, and they have I think it was three injectors going into the intake manifold. Interestingly, the injectors are the same injectors used for SCR, you know, for cleaning up diesel emissions. But in full throttle, hot conditions, they spray water into the intake manifold to cool the air intake charge and the pistons. And they say normally you'd just dump more fuel into the engine to cool it. But they're not doing it as a fuel efficiency move, even though it does help a little bit. They're doing it for pure power, and they're saying you can get 8 to 10% more power by going with this water injection. And I said, well, it's on a pace car. What's that mean? And they said, we're not saying anything.
So they just showed it on that pace car. I saw the pace car there. Right. It's for the... I forget what European series, European touring car or something.
MotoGP.
MotoGP, okay. But obviously we'll be seeing something like that in production before too long.
Yeah, so I found that intriguing. And the other thing I thought was interesting is that I remember reading about, you know, back in World War II when there was a lot of piston engine R&D going on, they were doing water injection into the combustion chamber to get that expansion from the water to get extra power. And that's what I thought this was at first. And they were like, no. This is in the intake manifold, and it's just to cool the charge and cool the pistons.
Because there's a problem if you just have water in there. The water is not compressible the same way that gasoline is, and so your engine would, well, I don't know, explode. That would not be a good thing. But the question also is that, okay, so they have a 1.3-gallon tank of water. That's what they're using. And so what happens if the water runs out?
It's a 5-gallon tank, I thought, they told me. And they said that because it only injects at full throttle and under very hot heavy load conditions, they said that the tank, even in heavy driving, should last you about as long as the gas in the fuel tank.
So when you go to the gas station, you fuel up your car and you're next to the nano fluid stand, which is
don't fill your BMW with salt water.
You pull the hose out.
So the water, once you flush it through, you're done. It kind of burns off.
Theoretically,
yeah.
Well, I'm sure because they're using these injectors that it's more atomized than back in World War II when they were basically shoveling water into the.
That's right. Hey, Carmen says we got another phone call coming in. What's bringing that in?
Hi, guys. This is Youngblood calling Cleveland, Ohio. I have a question. Since when did Geneva Motor Show, or the auto show, become the premier place to unveil all the new concepts. I was amazed on how many were there. I always thought that Detroit was the place. But I could just hope that next year at Detroit it will be the premier place for the Zora Corvette to be unveiled. Thank you. Later. Bye.
There is no Zora Corvette. He doesn't know about it.
Yeah, right.
But didn't John, isn't it your sense, you said that it's basically the show for the 1%?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. First, to answer Youngblood's question, the Geneva show has always been known as a design show. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's always how it's presented itself. And it brings out every little low-volume, super-expensive sports car maker that there is.
Koenigsegg is a high-volume sports car maker at Geneva compared with many of the others, seriously.
But it is kind of a one-percenter show.
So that's why all of these exotic concepts are shown, because it's, you know, that's where the banks are, right? I mean, it's Switzerland, for God's sake.
And we should talk about, too, a couple of other brands. Aston Martin had three cars, including this, I forget the name of the big sport utility electric. It's an electric sport utility coupe, which in production will have four doors. It was a little bit awkward looking. To me, it looked so big. It reminded me of when GM did two-door Coupe de Villes and Buick Electras in the early 1970s. It was that big compared with everything else on the stand. But it's supposed to appeal to, a younger and maybe skewing a little bit more female buyer. And Andy Palmer, the new CEO of Aston Martin, had them do that car very quickly. It was certainly the most controversial at the show,
I think. So you're saying a giant, ill-proportioned Aston Martin electric vehicle that's like an SUV is...
A coupe SUV,
Is going to skew toward the female customer.
Yeah, well... Yes, and it's all. Did I mention it's all electric? it's obviously they're looking to expand.
Fluids involved?
I don't know.
Yeah,
probably not. But it was kind of a funny looking. I don't know. What did you think of the Aston Martin?
I'd agree with everything that you said. I thought it looked a little ungainly. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm guessing they didn't want to give away what it might really look like, so they chopped the roof and made a coupe out of it.
Well, and Andy Palmer.
But that ruined the proportions.
It did. And Andy Palmer did have that thing done in 3 months.
So, yeah.
He came on board and said, I want an SUV.
Right. Well, look, the whole world's going to SUVs, right?
And every luxury brand.
Unfortunately.
Isn't that the four-door coupe?
But apparently the BMW X6 is working out all right. So then there's the new Audi R8, I thought. That was significant because it's a new R8.
It was a step backwards.
I'll tell you what.
Styling-wise.
Oh, no question. And here's the problem. It has TT syndrome. The TT and R8 were both so new and different when both launched that the question is, what do you do for the second generation? And there was just no way to do anything that would be, you know, it would have been interesting if they just started from a blank sheet and said, now let's draw a new mid-engine high-end sports car. But no, you have to appeal to the people who've been buying all those other R8s.
So in other words, because it was so successful, we've got to make the new one look sort of like the old one because the old one was so successful.
It's what I call Audi TT syndrome, although I remember when that was the slam on Honda Civics and Accords. Same thing. What do you do for a car that's so popular when the first of those, say the third generation Civic, was such a breakthrough? How do you do a breakthrough every generation? Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to excuse Audi for this. I think it would have been much more interesting if they said, okay, let's erase everything. Here's the engine. You know, let's draw a new sports car.
Now we'll have an R9.
Or why not just say, hey, that was its car and it ran its course and we'll be back in a few years with something totally different.
Yeah, well, obviously they're making money on the car.
Yeah. I guess, but I thought it was a step back.
Oh, I agree.
I think it's going to hurt the brand. Yeah. Not hurt it, but it's, you know, it was a step backwards.
Now, isn't that the one they're also going to be putting an electric powertrain in?
Yes.
Yeah, e-tron R8, right.
Right.
They've been showing that all.
And some of that's been on and off, but that's back on again. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Another technology I was wowed at, I stopped by the Harman display, and they had this noise cancellation system that lets every individual in the car listen to whatever they want at whatever volume they want without disturbing the person sitting next to, in front of, or in back of them. And it works really well. I was stunned by how well it works. So at least in the demonstration, it worked. So there's a very interesting technology. And they're also promoting noise cancellation technology for vehicles that are being lightweighted, engine downsized, and cylinder deactivation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, up to now, everybody's, and there's a lot of noise cancellation cars out there, but they use microphones in the cabin. What these guys are now doing is they've got sensors measuring the accelerator pedal position, engine RPM, engine load. So instead of noises coming from the engine making their way into the passenger compartment, and then the noise cancellation starts to work on it, this starts from the get-go, from as soon as you touch the pedal. Same with road noise. They have accelerometers in the shocks, and they're reading the accelerometers and anticipating what the noise generation is going to be and start canceling it. And so very intriguing, you know, because as cars get lighter and engines get downsized, I'm seeing it. I'm hearing it, you know, noisier interior cabins. And this technology would seem to solve that.
What about wind noise? Can that solve a wind noise problem?
That's a good question. I don't know, but I can't see why not.
Yeah.
I can't see why not at all. And especially since this, if you're cruising down the highway, the wind noise is kind of steady, mm-hmm. and noise cancellation works very well in steady state noises.
Well, apparently it eliminates unwanted frequencies from tire suspension and vehicle body components. So that might be the vehicle body components, might be the wind noise.
But we also ought to point out that Harman also has a technology for the electric sound synthesis to make your engine sound better.
Mm-hmm. Right.
On the inside or the outside of your car. So you know, some people like the sound of...
That's a little disheartening to me. I mean, you know, fine if you're talking about a luxury car, a family car, that maybe you want the engine to be quieter. But when you get a certain sort of noise, whether it's from a Ferrari V12 or from a small four-cylinder in something like a Mazda Miata or a Subaru BRZ, I kind of like that to be tactile and organic.
Come on, you're being too authentic here.
I'm with Todd. And, you know, I think where they're showing this technology, well, I'll tell you exactly where they showed me the technology was on the Toyota Avalon. Mm-hmm. And they said, here's a very quiet car and everything, and you step into it and nothing seems to happen. So they put a little grunt into the noise. So, you know, it sounds like the car is really getting up and going.
Can they do something about the way CVTs feel as they as you accelerate?
They probably could. They could mask that noise, too.
But you were talking before the show about this audio thing where you were listening to music and the guy who was sitting in the seat next to you.
And that's what I'm talking about, where everybody can listen to whatever they want at whatever volume they want. So the demo went like this. The guy puts on a song. It's AC/DC's Back in Black. And he cranks it out super loud. He's sitting in the back seat controlling all this. So I'm shouting at him, hey, you know, blah, blah, blah. He says, you don't have to shout. He says, I can't hear the music. And I'm like, you're kidding. He says, no. He says, now I'm going to play the music at the volume you're listening to for my seat. And my music goes away, and I can hear the song playing in the background. But now we're just having like a normal conversation, except he's shouting at me. And so this is really wild stuff where everybody in the car can listen to whatever they want.
So four positions, four people would be listening to different music and not
different
or
music,
talking or whatever.
Or if a phone call comes in, you take the phone call, you can have damn near a private conversation while everyone else is listening to Back in Black at 11.
Mm-hmm. And again, I can't wait until they sell this to Boeing and Airbus.
In airplanes. Yeah. No more crying babies.
No more crying
babies. That bother you anymore. So, hey, looks like we're at the top of the hour here. So, man, there's still more stuff we could talk about, but
Geneva always is a big show.
It was good. It was a good show. I'm glad that I went there.
And, yes.
It's kind of a throwback because, you know, on the floor of the show, they're very strict. Nothing in your booth can be more than a meter and a half high. So you can look out across the floor and see everything.
Yeah.
And they have signs that hang from the ceiling, and all the signs are exactly the same size, same font, same everything. And Man, I remember seeing pictures of the New York Auto Show from 1910, and that's exactly how they did it back then.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a throwback.
It is.
You know, and unless your display is against the perimeter walls, there's no big video screens, there's no double-decker kind of displays. It's just cars on a carpet kind of an approach.
But presumably if your car is higher than a meter and a half, you don't have to have it in a pit?
Well, no, if your car's that high, you can bring it into the show.
I'm trying to think about all that Aston SUV.
Yeah,
and,
you know, it's just like, it's got to be bigger.
Well, it was probably one of the tallest on the show, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, Todd, thanks for coming by.
John, thanks for having me.
That's cool. And Gary?
Okay. So next week, we'll have the program manager for the Edge here, the new Ford Edge.
Ford Edge.
Yeah.
And you just drove that.
I just drove that. I read about it at automobilemag.com.
Okay, cool. Want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There is all that and much more at autoline.tv.